Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Political Science, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Susan Liebel at St. Joseph's University, and today I'm pleased to be joined by David Paul Kuhn to discuss his new book, The Hard Hat Riot, Nixon, New York City, and the Dawn of the White Working Class Revolution, published by Oxford University Press in 2020. David Paul Kuhn is an author, reporter, and political analyst who served as a senior and chief political writer for Politico, Real Clear Politics, CBS, and other outlets. Many listeners will be familiar with his articles in the New York Times, Washington Post Magazine, Wall Street Journal, The Atlantic, The New Republic, and The Los Angeles Times, as well as his work as a political analyst on networks ranging from the BBC to Fox News. He has two previous books, The Neglected Voter, White Men and the Democratic Dilemma from St. Martin's in 2007, and a novel, What Makes It Worthy, published in 2015, that addressed the tabloidization of American politics and the power dynamics between the press and public officials. I'm delighted to welcome David to New Books in Political Science.
Thanks for having me. I look forward to the conversation.
So the Hard Hat Riot recalls a forgotten, violent attack by construction workers on Vietnam War protesters. To help us better understand the current polarization in the United States in 2020, especially in terms of white working class men, the hard hats become the stand-ins for voters who were part of FDR's Democratic Party, but became the members of Nixon's silent majority. The reaction to the violence in your telling maps onto polarization patterns in the early 21st century. And the book's larger claim is that the hard hat rebellion contextualizes Donald Trump's 2016 victory over Hillary Clinton and the continuing resentment from white working class voters. But the book describes an incident that was front page news in 1970, but unlike Kent State that happened just 4 days before, the hard hat riot didn't enter our vocabulary and it's been forgotten by many. So let's start with recalling the event itself. What happened on May 8th, 1970? New York's financial district had been the site of many protests, but this particular protest resulted in a riot with over 100 people injured. Start us off by what happened on this day.
If you will, I'm just going to fade out for a moment just to give a little more context. On April 20th, 1970, Nixon pledges the withdrawal of 150,000 troops from Vietnam. And many of the best newspapers presume this was the first step and reported that it was the first step of the drawdown of the Vietnam War, that the Vietnam War is all but over, to quote the Chicago Tribune. 10 days later, Nixon announces the expansion of the war into Cambodia, and activism explodes in the United States. Basically, the anti-war movement is revitalized from the University of Maryland to Oregon State. ROTC facilities are firebombed, vandalized. There's, again, unrest unlike anything. It's even unlike anything we experience today. And then that leads to a college no one had heard of. On May 4th, Kent State in Ohio, and of course now we know Kent State, and recall the tragedy of those 13 seconds where four young college students are killed and nine are wounded. And then after that, basically the Dow Jones declines to the to the greatest extent since JFK's assassination. ROT facilities are struck with firebombings from, again, across the country, Rhode Island, Kentucky, Missouri state schools throughout. Elite schools are hit too. It's the anti-war movement is unlike anything the United States had seen in the modern day at that time. And New York City is simmering. It has over 40 colleges. It has a very active counterculture movement. We forget how much the counterculture was born out of New York City. It's sort of associated with California in many respects. And there's unrest on Wall Street for days. Basically, the Wall Street is a center of protest because they're viewed as the masters of capitalism and the masters of war. And then May 8th, 1970, days of scuffles and smaller conflicts between construction workers and anti-war activists basically climax into a terrible confrontation. And that terrible confrontation occurs because of an accident of history. At the same time, the protest movement is down on Wall Street. New York City is experiencing second skyscraper age. And most famously, the World Trade Center is being built where there are 5,000 construction workers alone. And because of this coincidence and these two tribes, if you will, of America who viewed each other almost unfathomably different at this point, and we'll just use a shorthand, hard hats and hippies, if you will, allowing that it's a generalization, were confined to this narrow landmass of lower colonial Manhattan, only a kilometer wide because there's no Battery Park City yet. And that leads to a confrontation unlike anything we saw on that day of May 8th. And it will lead to New York City's financial district being overrun, City Hall being sieged, and really a mass violence unlike anything, especially in a wealthy area of New York City, the city had experienced in that era.
It's a remarkable story, and the book is a page turner. I am from New York. I'm from Queens. I worked in the World Trade Center in the 80s and have walked all of the streets that you discuss in the book. And so it's very, very close for me. I don't need to imagine how small that space is. Yeah. And despite the fact that I grew up in New York, that I worked in the Trade Center, that I walked those streets, I'd never heard of this event. So I'm wondering, where did you get the idea to do the project? And how long have you been working on this idea?
Well, you very kindly mentioned my first two books in the introduction. And my first book was on Democrats' historic issues with whites, especially men, and the other side of the gender gap, if you will, of what we call the gender gap. And that book in 2007, I traveled through history, the history leading up to the Reagan Democrat, if you will, and then the elections after. And there was no moment in my mind when I did that book that was a better microcosm of when the FDR coalition fractured than the Hard Hat Riot. So it was always in my head as a microcosm. Trump runs for president. The national media rediscovers working class whites in 2015 and 2016, just like they did in 1969 after Richard Nixon's shocking comeback. And victory, and we'll go into that history. And after that happened, I didn't want to write pure analysis like my first book. And so I wanted to write a lesson of history and focus on this history. And so I decided to do a focus on a microcosm of this riot, which has largely been forgotten. And I would only do that if I could find these original records that I knew existed or I thought had to exist, but I wasn't sure. And so I found the protein of the story I wanted to tell. And so my hope was to sort of tell that story in a novel-esque fashion for one of three parts. And then in the beginning, part one, give the backdrop part, and then part two, focus on the riot. And the third part, the aftermath going into Nixon's blue collar strategy, and finally the 1972 campaign. because, of course, as many of your listeners know, by 1972, between Goldwater and McGovern, the American tectonics of politics had shifted. And I think it would be agreeably stated at a political science conference that we have the beginning of what is modern polarization in that era.
No, and actually, Lily Gorin and I interviewed Lori Cox Han about her book on the Pat Buchanan memos. And that work, if you haven't seen it, is unbelievable in just listening to Pat Buchanan lay out the strategy and Nixon respond to it, because we have the tapes, because we have these incredible memos, or she actually obtained these incredible memos. So actually, the people listening, a lot of them love to know the sort of archival story. So tell us a little bit more about these documents. Where were they? And maybe even, you know, a couple of your aha moments in those archives documents that changed how you viewed the story or changed the direction of this book.
So what's interesting about this book is I really was ambivalent on writing the book at all. I felt for all the talk of the white working class, and then obviously other topics, I think that even those who despise Donald Trump and his presidency will agree, return to the fore because of Donald Trump, right? Globalization, how trade had decimated aspects of especially the industrial Midwest. I felt like I was torn, because as much as the Hard Hat Riot I thought was the best and most cinematic microcosm to bring readers in to this moment, I was also torn because there were so many riots of that era, and Detroit and Newark saw significantly more fatalities. And I wasn't sure I wanted to tell this story for that reason. Then I got the original research, and what made me want to tell this story at the outset was that, unlike Stonewall, which happened only the year before, right, the beginning of the gay rights movement, as we now look back, and those terrible, the worst riots of the mid and late 60s, this story hadn't been told. And I believe it hadn't been told because, as I write in the introduction, you know, there's the axiomatic saying in history that winners write history. And we think of that in terms of wars between nations, but I think it also applies to cultural conflicts within nations. And I think if we're honest about it, those who write our culture and teach in our universities are children of, or quite literally are, the baby boomer counterculture cultural generation that I think you could say won the culture before it won the politics. And as I've dived into these documents and really discovered that there was a story to tell that hadn't been told, my curiosity just, it was like kindling on a fire. So basically, to get quickly into the records, to the extent it interests your readers or your listeners, there was this, after the Hard Hat Riot happened, which shocked the establishment for obvious reasons because it's occurring on Wall Street, Lindsay, the mayor of New York City at the time, who was a national figure, was pressured into coming down hard on the New York Police Department, where there was, like many mayors and the NYPD, it was a very tense relationship. He ordered an investigation by the NYPD, to the dismay of those who were injured and the ACLU and many groups. There was never an outside investigation by a third party. So unlike Kent State, unlike Chicago 68, unlike the Columbia occupation, there was never an outside third party who investigated the Hard Hat Riot. But what there was, and what I knew there was an NYPD investigation. And what I knew about the NYPD of this era was that it was both highly professional compared to most police departments and also highly corrupt. So I wanted to see if I could get the records behind their investigation, because what happened is the riots in May, and in August, the NYPD puts forth a 40-page report, and it acquits itself in this report, not surprisingly. But I knew that behind all that report would be thousands, and though I never expected many more than thousands, 10, you know, 8,000 man hours, as it was, to use a term of the time, of NYPD interviews and investigations. So what I was hoping to get was all the documents behind the NYPD public report. I also knew that because the ACLU tried a lawsuit, that the affidavits of that lawsuit have to somewhere be entered into the public record. So my goal was to get all the meat behind all the research behind the end result. And I've, of course, started with FOIL and FOIA, basically Freedom of Information Act requests in 2017, both to the FBI and every New York City agency. And long story short, the NYPD and FBI would obstruct it in every way possible. But I eventually got a FOIL on appeal release from the NYPD. And then I discovered that these records, this was a big aha moment, that there was separate litigation that forced the NYPD to move all their intelligence files out of their purview and into the New York City archives. But no one had gone through, I'm just going to give a rough number, 90 to 95% of those records. So that made me think.
That's the kind of thing that writers salivate over.
I was just going to say, this is where reporters and academics share something, and where the Venn diagram crosses over deeply. That's right. That's to use a crasser term, that's like the wet dream of anybody reporting this research. It really was amazing. I knew once I found that out, I was like, okay, the only thing that would stop those records from being there would be if something corrupt took place, so which was not impossible. So I basically, working with the equivalent of the New York City archives, the archivists effectively were trying, unlike the officials at the FBI or the NYPD and so forth, they truly believe in the spirit of the Freedom of Information Act, and they gave me access to the records before they were able to go through those records and professionally, the term used, as your listeners will know, is unprocessed. The records were unprocessed. Yeah. So when I got to the records and discovered them, they were as they were when the NYPD closed the investigation in 1970. They were disorganized, and raw. But I mean, I had every interview. I had the notes from every interview they did. They interviewed over 300 witnesses. There were over 2,000 pages that ultimately of, you know, arrest reports, memos, everything that they were all, it was all there, it all recorded. And so it really was everything I'd hoped for. And so I went through all the records before they were processed, to use the term of archivist. And then that became the protein behind my timeline. Again, this is for the riot itself. I created a timeline that was hundreds of pages, and using that, and then I would weave in, in the timeline I would create, I would weave in then newspaper articles or affidavits or any piece of data, trying to come up with as best as I could trying to retell history to them, you know, in 5 minute, even minute interval, to the extent I could, so I could get the sequence of events correct. Because even in the amazing journalism that followed some great journalism that followed the Hardhat riot, well-intentioned searching stories, there were just immense errors. What I started to discover, I was interviewing eyewitnesses, people experienced it 47, 48 years after it happened. And although they had the best of intentions, we're talking some at times Harvard educated, extremely intelligent people, they just didn't remember huge portions of their experience during the riot, and that were clear from the contemporaneous documents. So I, after doing some in-person interviews and in as many as I thought were necessary, I started to realize I needed to rely above all on the contemporaneous documents. And so I tried to recreate a narrative of the riot first, and get the history right, as to the extent that I would feel comfortable if I was a prosecutor going in front of a jury with the story I would tell. And And then, I wanted to make it vivid and a page turner, as you noted, for that portion. And I ended up cutting, actually, I note in the book 5,000 words, but probably closer to 8,000 or 10,000 words from the narrative I wrote just of the riot, because, of course, it was a balance between wanting to do my sort of, I felt responsible to history to tell the story. At the same time, people only want to go into so much detail about any historical single day event. So I had to make sure that the riot stayed, a gripping story while telling that story. And as the history allowed, how in that day, it was a microcosm of this fracturing of the FDR coalition. And then use that as sort of the hinge to tell this larger story of when that FDR coalition broke apart and this beginning of what would become to be known a decade later of the Reagan Democrat.
So first of all, I want to say that absolutely comes through in the reading of the book. And if you're like me and you toggle back and forth between the footnotes and the, you also have a little source epilogue at the end, you can see where each of these comments is coming from. So that was, as I was reading, I was trying to think, what's the difference between this book and a book that would be written by Dr. Kuhn, who teaches history somewhere else, as opposed to a reporter? And one of the things I noticed was the emphasis on the primary documents, the emphasis on the oral history, as opposed to tons of secondary document manuscripts and articles that contextualize things. That seemed to be sort of the reporter in you showing, as well as the historian in you. I had a question though. Was there any case in which you were interviewing in the present somebody who had also been interviewed by the police in the past, and you
Absolutely.
Were comparing their future? And okay, so
yeah, that's what I don't want to go too far into sort of incidents in New York City, whether it's the Central Park Five or frankly incidents during the Nuremberg trials that I think that have taught us a lot about issues with eyewitness testimony, especially eyewitness testimony that you eat for whatever your biases are, you kind of want to believe. So when I would interview, so what happened was, is I started interviewing, I started interviewing individuals who experienced riot, whether they were victims or they worked for Mayor Lindsay, just to give two examples, or witnesses. And there were, not only was there conflicts, direct conflicts, or immense gaps in what they told me and what they found, or what existed in the contemporaneous documents, but I also, again, I'm Trump guarding my words because I don't want to give too much detail to in any way say anything negative about any one individual. I will just say, first of all, the way I came into this humbly, as I started to realize that these issues, was that I was there on 9/11 at the World Trade Center and experienced it, the horrors of that day, right at Ground Zero, and saw some terrible things. And that was a lot more recent than the Hard Hat Riot, and arguably a more traumatic event, even compared to those who got beaten unconscious that day, or equally traumatic. And I question my own memory from that moment. I don't know how much of my memory was influenced by the media I saw afterward. And so to talk to people several decades later than that timeline, I think unfortunately not everyone can find contemporaneous documents, but I think that historians and reporters writing history in which they over-rely on contemporaneous retrospective interviews decades later should, there should be an immense amount of humility, because in my case, I caught direct conflicts with what they told police then or said in affidavits then, compared to what they, with the best of intentions, recalled of that day.
No, that's, it's not something that many historians have the luxury of being able to do, but the immense humility really strikes me as a term that would resonate with a lot of academics and reporters who've been in the same shoes. So the book is divided into three parts: backdrop, Bloody Friday, and afterward and aftermath. It's a long book. For listeners, I want to say it is a long book, but it's also a page turner. So it's one of these books that sort of looks intimidating, but actually when you start it is not something that you have to eat your Wheaties to read. We're not going to cover everything in the backdrop, but let's start with a little bit of how you see the events that lead up to this moment in which the construction workers would physically attack these Vietnam protesters who are standing there. So let's start with a little bit about 68 and 69 and Lindsay and how we can understand this moment in New York City politics.
Absolutely, really in national politics, because we should begin with the fact that I chose New York City for a reason. It's not just that the Hard Hat Riot is a microcosm of the fraction of the FDR coalition in this era. It's that New York City, counterintuitively for those who only know the modern New York, is in many ways that, or as I put in the book, Gotham is indicative of the middle American squeeze, as it's put in that day, to use the vernacular of that day. And New York City, the majority of New York City residents are blue-collar whites still by 1970. It experienced the deindustrialization of America before most of America in the 50s, only a couple decades earlier. New York City is a manufacturing hub of the United States. And there is the manufacturing sector, other sectors like longshoremen, they're utterly decimated by the mid to late 60s. So there was the aspect of wanting to show through New York City the deindustrialization of the United States, right? Because the factories will leave the Northeast, then they'll leave the North, then they'll go to the South, and eventually they'll leave America. I wrote this book thinking that the worry that the law and order issue and that topic would appear antiquated to readers, never expecting what we've experienced this summer. And I devoted, without even intending, two chapters to this issue. I thought I should reframe it a little bit from what had been done before. I wanted to show how the law and order issue grew out of the decline of cities. And again, tell that story while talking about other cities, tell that story through New York City. Many people still today, including some who have written retrospectives of the late 60s, associate the 70s with New York City's decline. It started in the mid 60s. In fact, John Lindsay ran in the mid 60s to be mayor of New York City with the slogan to say one ad, something can be done, right? Quote unquote. So New York City is experiencing not only deindustrialization, a rise in crime, just like the nation is, a significant rise in crime. By the late 60s, starts to begin to be exponential rise in crime. The pollution is poisoning New York City's air. For example, mortality from pulmonary emphysema increases 500% in the 1960s in New York City. And so we forget how much that was a blight of that period. And I wanted to give that context. I also wanted, one thing that I struggled with is, do I tell some important antecedents, right? And so if you're two of those antecedents that I decided what were very important stories had been told by books in and of themselves. One was the Columbia occupation, right? 1968, which is a precursor of Chicago 68. And of course, Chicago 68 story has been well told. I did not entirely agree with how those stories were told. And so I wanted to focus on, I wanted to give those antecedents because they both showed a narrative thread that came out of the Hard Hat Riot and would pervade this era. And that is that for all the discussion of the generation gap, in the 1960s, the great divide, for example, on Vietnam and on many of these issues were matters of class. And even when you isolate the polling to, for example, 20 to 30 year olds or 20-somethings in that period, 18 to 30-year-olds, you see this class gap between those with some college education or a college four-year degree and those whose education never exceeded high school. Obviously, because it's 1970, when I'm looking at data, I'm including those with some education because you could have a very good life with even some, even whether it's a high school degree at that time or some post high school education. And that polling is not much in the, it's all deep in the notes because I don't want to bore the average reader, but it's there and it's the spine of my book. And I have it there for historians and academics and reporters because I do feel for, let's just, and of course, as you know, when I'm giving the backdrop, I focus on Vietnam. And I do feel even with Vietnam, if I can, I feel I can punch up here to Ken Burns. Ken Burns, as amazing as he is and as much of an institution of American life as I think he is, I think his very in-depth recent documentary on the Vietnam War left out an immense part of that war. And that is that those with, that unlike any war since at least the Civil War, and I suspect more than the Civil War, those with less died at higher rates and were asked to go to the, those with less had never, were asked to do the fighting and dying in whether they were black or white or Hispanic. And in the Vietnam War, and to some extent, I think it's been for, this part of it has been written about, but still not digested to the degree it should be, becomes the most awful and tragic example of this class strain between whites in American life that pervades the 60s and early 70s.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You had a little Freudian slip there on the gender thing. So let me ask you a question, because there were two things that sort of struck me about this first part of the book. First of all, it's very well written, and you do a really nice job of pulling back the lens and not having it be unidimensional. So I really liked that aspect of it. But this is really a story about men. And actually, you use the word people a lot, but it really, as I was reading the book, I thought it would actually be more accurate to say that the resentments that you're mostly focused on in terms of the construction workers and also the behavior of the police are in these predominantly male occupations that have a certain kind of culture that is different from all people. And second, race. So the book is taking place from the late 60s to the 70s. But race is somewhat in the backdrop here. I mean, you emphasize the class differences in the fighting in Vietnam, but don't lean as heavily into the fact that more black and brown people were both in the war and died at higher rates than their general population numbers would.
Can I step in there? Yeah, of course. Okay, one. It's true that African Americans in the Vietnam War served and died on the battlefield at higher rates early in the war, but by the end of the war, African Americans died at the rate of the population. Secondly, when you look at those who did die, and I think what is often forgotten, those who had who served in the war in forward aspects that were made them much more likely to die were far and away, whether they were African Americans or blue collar working class whites and Hispanics. In other words, actually on Vietnam, it's class. And when you look at also on resentments, class pervades much more than race. And, you know, I have all the hard data in the book to back that up. But I think you touched on something that is true, like a larger story, right? So, which is, you know, first of all, why is not race in the foreground of the book? And is this a story of just of men, right? Of working class white men and not working class women? Well, one, to what you said about the hard, let's just say the hard hats and jobs that are dominated by men, could also be said about the anti-war movement, right? It is, some of the most famous, if not the most famous episodes of the anti-war movement, Chicago 68, roughly 9 in 10 of those arrested are young men in Chicago 68, for example. So I think that it's true that for many reasons, including most obviously sexism, men were at the fore of both sides of this divide. It is true that, which is why I did that first book, that by the Reagan era, the gender gap, basically because men left the Democratic Party, is essential to the story. But what we start seeing in the 60s and 70s is that all these issues and resentments show up in working class white women as well as working class white men. And there was that said, obviously, if you make the hard hat riot, if you decide that's the microcosm to center your story around, you're telling a story where mostly almost entirely male construction workers beat up mostly male anti-war activists and or let's just again to use the shorthand of the time with all the generalizations and faults of generalizations that come with that term, hippies, right? So most of the injured that day were men as well. And so, I mean, it's true that to tell this story, it becomes extremely male. And I think, if I can jump into the present, one difference between the protests today for probably the Black civil rights issue of our time, right, is that women are at the fore of at least African-American activism in the way they were not with either the Black Panthers and certainly not with the anti-war movement. It's hard, and we'll see how that, the impact that has. But I think that the trend you're noting pervades both sides of this divide. On race, it's...
Let me actually just jump in here for a second, yeah. David, because I want to make sure we stay on track with your book. I don't want to insert myself as an expert in something I'm not. I think that there would be... I think there'd be quite a bit of a back and forth if we had a scholar here of Black mobilization in the civil rights movement, because as you know, like people may know John Lewis's name, but he co-founded SNCC with a woman, and there's many, many women who are involved in the civil rights movement, even if the faces are Malcolm X and Martin Luther King at the very top. And it is true, the Black Panthers have a very different organization. It's not, but it's complicated. And my question was more just about race in general, that one can tell a story about deindustrialization or resentment of elites leading to white working class people leaving the Democratic Party, or one can add at least a third factor, which would have to do with state sovereignty, racism, desegregation, affirmative action, et cetera. So that's all I was sort of trying to ask about how, like, you made the decision about those lenses. And the one other question I just have in terms to get this number out, because I think it's really interesting in the book for the listeners, is that you write that 25% of the injured people the day of the attack were women. And I think what I'm hearing you say now, and probably I missed it in the book and I apologize, are you saying that 25% of the protesters were women?
No, I don't have any data on the protest. I can only go by, just like on Chicago 68, I can't, I don't think there's any data that can say who were the 5,000 to 10,000 protesters. I can only go by arrests and injury reports. Right?
Okay, so no, it came off earlier as you were saying, as if it was white construction workers attacking white male protesters. So the protester mix is not exclusively male. Just to make sure that's
no,
clear to everybody.
No, the protester mix is not exclusively male. I'm just pointing out that based on the only way you can find data, which is, you know, in these incidents such as the arrests in Chicago 68 or the injury list that day, it's still very male on both sides.
Right. Okay.
And some of the incidents that got the most media attention for, as they should, were when, were some of these incidents when some of the female protesters were injured. So we're touching on two of the most, two central issues of modern, historiography. And right. So to what extent, right, is gender a part of all this and race? I will say this, that as I say in the book, in the introduction, you know, this is one story of this period. Two, I'm talking about a story that hasn't been told. And I think it's fair to say that the story of this, whatever term we want to use, is called the Southern Flip or racism's role in the modern Democratic, how the modern Democratic and Republican coalitions came about is a story that's well told. I think the story that is undertold, and the reason I told this story is the story that I think is undertold for a reason. Is the class strain between whites, and I should tell this story, and that it was really important, is that not everything was as racially divided as we remember now. For example, I when I'm talking about the decline of cities and concerns about about the activism throughout the country, as I note in the book, 7 in 10 whites and a plurality of blacks saw quote unquote radical troublemakers as the cause of student unrest rather than quote unquote deeply felt beliefs in the quote unquote injustices of society. So, I can go through data after data that, again, I put in notes because I don't want to bore the reader, but, there is on even issues as politically toxic as crime in the late 60s, there is also agreement between whites and blacks on the issue, on how serious the issue is, and on issues of how the activism of the late 60s and early 70s was viewed, as I show, whites in general, but had a more derisive view of college activists, which, let's be honest, is probably they're picturing a white face from a middle-class suburb when they hear that term in the late 60s, of college activists than they did of civil rights workers. And that was all these resentments towards any activism were stronger among blue-collar whites than they were among more educated whites. But one reason I wanted to I wrote this book and I thought it was important is that I think class is an under-discussed aspect of what dogs and defines our politics. And I think that we don't talk enough about the class strain between whites. And as that came to the fore when Donald Trump became was taken seriously as a candidate in 2015, or began to be taken a little seriously, and then eventually co-opted the momentum in the GOP primary and eventually wins the nomination, and the media rediscovered the working class whites. I wanted to remind people also of this time that the exact same thing happened in 1969, and there was a flood of articles. First, it began with Chicago 68, and then Nixon's. Again, we forget how shocking his comeback and eventual win of the presidency was in 68 to establishments of all sorts. The media started this beginning with a New Yorker article and then an article in the New York Magazine. And then basically every major publication in American life and certainly the networks started to focus on and rediscover blue collar whites. I use the term rediscovered because the Washington Post in a front page story did a story on news reporters rediscovering blue collar whites. It was such a, they had been put to the side so long that the very fact that they were being covered became news in and of itself. And so, as I note in the book, to the extent of since the Great Depression and into the 50s, the quote unquote everyman is given a rose colored portrait, is put on a pedestal, perhaps to an excessive degree, right? With an example being that at a haven of capitalism such as Rockefeller Center, you have portraits of icons of the FDR sort of New Deal worker drawn as demigods. To the extent he or she was seen rosily in that era, the pendulum had swung radically, and by the mid and late 60s, the middle American, quote unquote, was viewed somewhere between derisively and or seen certainly by the activists in the day eventually as a impediment to progress in every way. And it's in this era that they become the face of what the new left felt they opposed. And you start to see this, the polarization that has defined our politics, I think, to this day.
No, thanks for the, it's a large part of the book, and it's quite difficult to summarize it in a podcast. So I appreciate you even being willing to try. Before we move to the riot itself, is there any aspect of this backdrop that you feel we haven't addressed and you want to say something about before we go to the actual events of the riot?
No, I feel like we've definitely surveyed a good portion of that period. And, you know, obviously we're speaking in shorthand, and many of the things we're talking about are sort of at the center of American history since the Second World War and deserve a much more substantial discussion. And I don't mean to at times sound reductive or simplify issues such as race or gender that rightly are have earned you know, attention of scholarship since especially the 80s.
One of the things that's interesting about the book is the photographs that are in the section on the day of the violence. And actually, I guess I'll start by saying people have to think so carefully about their titles, and your title clearly tries to kind of give the overarching claim of the book. Is the word hard hat riot something that was in the news, et cetera, that you had looked at, or was that something that you developed and picked out as appropriate? What was the balance there?
It was called after the hard hat riot. It happens on a Friday. Kent State's on a Monday. The riot happens on a Friday. The famous national protest in Washington is that Saturday over what happens in Kent State. By Monday, the Wall Street Journal, for example, has a headline referring to what happened on Friday as Bloody Friday, quote unquote, okay, which is, you know, one of the terms I use. But if in a matter of weeks, the word riot is applied, clearly being applied to it, and it comes to be known as the hard hat riot over time. I was not sure whether I wanted that to be the title of the book. I was not sure about the subtitle. As it will not surprise some of your listeners, the publisher had a great amount of influence on this decision. It was not left to the author. And maybe the publisher was right. I'm not, but regardless, that's sort of how the title came about, that the Hard Hat Riot would come to be known. You know, that would be the term as would come to be known. I should just note for your listeners that one reason I focused on this is that sometimes, just to remind everyone, what becomes seminal is not appreciated in its time. We should remember that, you know, only the summer before we have what happens in the village with Stonewall riots, right? What's considered now a seminal moment in the beginning of the gay rights movement. But at the time, it was buried inside the New York Times coverage of it, right? Only got a few column inches. It was barely covered. And this is in the New York Times. So sometimes these moments, we only see we only see in the rearview mirror how much certain moments capture, trends that come to define American life.
Were the reporters there? I know you mentioned that there's some attack of reporters and smashing of cameras, which would mean film was lost. But did they come to report this? How good was the reporting?
I think the reporting of the day was as good as you could expect. I mean, first of all, unlike Chicago 68, which has the national press, the world press, but especially the national press, around and there for all the bloody moments. There was not much media downtown when this happened, and the media, the little bits of press that were there, were either attacked or ran off. So there is not. So the reportage was imperfect, and there weren't anywhere near the photographs, for example, of say Chicago 68. I think for reasons of working under deadline more than anything else, and not having a bird's eye view of everything, I think the reporting was fine. I caught errors in all the major stories, including whether all the major outlets. I think those were errors of, that within the framework of good intentions. And mm-hmm. I used reporting for the storyline when I could find other reporting that could back up that reporting. So, I mean, basically the foundation of how I sort of went about everything was I was an intern long, long ago for Time Magazine's Nation section, sort of the old Time Magazine. And I was taught by their fact checkers. They used to have, the second largest private library in the United States back then. And I learned their fact checking system. And I tried to use that fact checking system of the old Time Magazine often in how I would sort, say, media accounts.
Wow, that's saying something about your mentorship at Time Magazine.
That old Time Magazine was amazing. I find it, and I will just one side note for, as I think any historian who writes about this era would probably agree. What's amazing to read, I just want to point, if you read Time Magazine, for example, in the 70s or 60s, it's amazing because this was considered a quote unquote middle brow publication. I think the writing is terrific. It's fact checked. It has the feel of the writers being well read, and it just mm-hmm. shows how much has been lost.
An expectation of the audience. Sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah,
expectation
you're right.
Of the audience to follow that kind of level of in-depth discussion. Let me ask you a little bit about, I think you're so steeped in it, and now I've read your book, of what happens this day, particularly. What's the setup? You've already said that the construction workers were concentrated in this small section of Manhattan. They were working on the World Trade Center. What happens, and what is the behavior of the police? How long does it continue? Just give us a, obviously don't give it the whole thing, but some idea of what actually happens that day.
So the day before, the Thursday, the day before this happens, the NYPD beginning around 4:20 p.m. and then soon other city agencies start receiving peculiar phone calls. And basically they start getting calls that the Hard Hats are going to start trouble for the anti-war protest tomorrow, right? The Friday of May 8th. And by the morning, agencies from the NYPD to City Hall will have gotten warning calls that something was going to happen at noontime that day, at high noon, it turns out. Luckily, it was a cold and rainy morning that morning. And so a lot less people came to the protest than would have come. And they were expecting 10,000, only 1,000 to 2,000 arrived that morning. What happened was, and the reason it became so chaotic is it happened over lunchtime. And so you had the massive lunchtime crowd in the streets of the financial district. And as the chaos ensues, New Yorkers want to witness it for themselves. And people start leaving their office spaces to come down to the streets or peering from their windows, and windows are opening up throughout the cavern throughout Broadway and throughout downtown Manhattan as witnesses from the street to high 44, 54 up and floors up and skyscrapers watch the riot take over the streets from noon on. Basically, construction workers come from several directions on Wall Street. They start getting police tries to separate the two tribes with a demilitarized zone, if you will, to use a vernacular of the time. That eventually fails. The Hardhats are yelling at the cops about getting a flag up in front of Federal Hall. It just happens that all of this is occurring where George Washington was inaugurated as our first president. And the spark, as I can discern, it was a Viet Cong flag that was being waved by one to two anti-war activists on the steps, only feet from the construction workers who are pushing against the police. And at the moment that they surged forward, some 800 office workers had joined in their yelling to put up the American flag, and they had sort of bolstered the back of the line of the construction workers. And of course, and I should note, one reason I focused on this riot as a microcosm is that you have this interesting union of businessmen and workmen, to use gender terms, if you allow that.
We need to use those terms because they're accurate. I worked down there in the early 80s, and the construction workers were men, and they were yelling at people like me, and the business community was mostly male. So I think actually it's really important for us to use these words as they apply.
Now the crowd, absolutely. Yes, and the crowd is not overwhelmingly male, right? So the crowd are just lunchtime workers. So there are clerks and secretaries and some business women. It is 1970. Some of the ceiling was beginning to be shattered. The crowd is just typical financial district crowd. And then as the riot moves to City Hall, it's typical New York City sort of bureaucratic crowd, right? Because you have the federal building, you have the federal courthouse there, you have New York City courthouses, you have City Hall, you have it's where all the municipal governmental workers are in Manhattan at that time, mostly, I should say. And so these workers are all in the streets, and basically as the line breaks, the police, it's fair to say too many police did too little, and they stepped aside because, as I note in the book, and as we saw earlier with other antecedents like Chicago 68, the cops were largely blue collar from Irish and Italian backgrounds. They grew up in the same neighborhoods as the construction workers. They had the same haircuts. They went to the same churches, the same bars. And like the construction workers, disproportionately came from military ranks. The majority of the construction workers were almost surely veterans, either of World War II or of Korea or some of Vietnam. As I note, there were Vietnam veterans in the police ranks and in the construction ranks, young men. And they surge forward, and a mass melee ensues, and it eventually works its way up Wall Street, and they siege City Hall in a respect that had not been seen since the Civil War era.
It's really an extraordinary picture to paint. When you pull the lens back yourself and think about Nixon, Lindsay, the new left versus the white working class ideals, what are your conclusions at the end of the book? What do you walk away from your own reporting and examination of all of these documents and everything that you read to produce this book?
It's clear that that for the middle American, which overlaps with blue collar whites at that time, right? Because when we're talking about the middle American of this time, the country is very white, and we're really talking about whites in the suburbs and in cities. And for middle Americans, we're talking about whites also in, of course, rural America. It's fair to say that they felt that the values that they had grown up and still cherished felt inverted to them, right? So they working men were framed as fools working for the man. Motherhood was suddenly being described in slavish terms and in negative terms for housewives. They felt that veterans suddenly saw the very object they venerated, and that in their minds, and not just veterans, the average American at that time, that in their minds reminded them of the best of America, suddenly become a symbol of disfavor with the United States. We forget, which I try to remind the reader of, it had only been a matter of years by 1970 that the American flag is a popular means to express disfavor with the United States. And flag desecration, and most visibly with the burning of a flag, was shocking at that time to the average American. And so we see competing notions of patriotism and views of the United States that, and of American culture that that are very familiar in our time and I think rooted to this time.
What has the reaction been to the book? I know that this book has come out in the midst of a pandemic, so you haven't had as many face-to-face encounters as you probably expected to have when you were writing the book, but what has the reaction been from different audiences?
It's hard to say. Obviously, this book came out during a pandemic. I would say that, you write a book like this and you do a few things. One is I knew because I'm talking about the dissolution of the FDR coalition. And as you just noted, there's a prevailing story of how an overly reductive story that presumes that it's always the worst in them. I use to put it in the terms of the time, it's like a breakup and it's all him and not me, or it's all her and not me. It's her fault or it's his fault. I don't think the story is that black and white, if I can use that term. And I wanted to, I'm sorry, maybe we should redo. I'm getting off subject here. Why don't we do a redo here?
Perfect. Yep. Absolutely. No worry. Don't worry. It's a long interview. Just don't. This happens all the time. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
Do you want me to, start with the reaction to the book, or where would you like, what's the best place?
Okay. Yeah. Let's just,
let's just go back to that. So David, I know this book came out during a pandemic and you weren't expecting to not go face to face with your audiences who have read it or are interested in it. You were thinking about book signings, et cetera. What has the reaction to the book been from different audiences, and did it surprise you, or was it what you expected?
Well, first, most importantly, I did hear from those on all sides of this turmoil, including victims of the riot that day who were part of the anti-war movement. And I heard from for example, one of those I interviewed, the last remaining union leader who would eventually meet with Nixon at in the weeks after the Hard Hat riot, as Nixon seeks to co-opt this energy and formulate his blue collar strategy. I heard from people from all sides, and I had really heartfelt emails and saying that they felt the story would be told. And that's obviously heartwarming and makes you feel great as a reporter and a writer. But writ large in the country, I knew I was talking about minefields if you're writing any story about the dissolution of the fracturing of the FDR coalition beginning in the 60s. So that's a real reason why the notes are so immense and why I try to back everything up with data as much as I can in the notes and records, because I am walking a minefield and talking about these topics. And I would say the reaction of the media, it's hard to say. I guess it's been really lovely to read these wonderful reviews. Obviously, like any writer, I'm happy that the reviews were so positive from the major newspapers like the Journal and the Times and the Washington Post. And I do, of course, because this book came out during a pandemic, I do wish there was more one-on-one with readers and debates about the pertinence of the turmoil of that time and this time. I do speak with, you know, groups of whether it's, you know, even book clubs virtually, but it's just not the same thing. But considering it came out during a pandemic, I just, you know, I'm happy that it got the reception it did. And I hope that, you know, I hope that the research behind the book, again, in the notes, helps, contributes in some small way to fill out the story of this era. Again, I never claim, and I make a clear introduction, this is the only story of how the FDRL coalition broke apart.
I know this book has taken up a lot of your time, but do you have a next project in your head or in your apartment?
I'm not sure. I'm still digesting the experience of doing this book and everything it took to put it together, especially the research and reporting before I even started writing. And that raises larger questions about writing books and maybe a post-literacy age. I'm just not sure. So I have to think about a lot. I'm very grateful that the book got the reception it did. And I'm grateful to be on shows like this and to be part of the discussion. I am not sure what I'm going to write next.
Well, if you write another book, please come back to New Books in Political Science. Thank you so much for taking this much time so that we could have a more sort of nuanced back and forth about what is a really beautifully researched and well-written book that enhances our understanding of the complexity of this period. The new book is David Paul Kuhn's The Hard Hat Riot, Nixon, New York City, and the Dawn of the White Working Class Revolution. It's published by Oxford University Press. You can get it on the Oxford website. You can also, as we are recommending, use bookshop.org to support your brick and mortar bookstores, particularly while some of them are closed. If you're in places like New York City, walk into a bookstore and get it there. Again, thank you so much, David, for joining me today.
It was a real pleasure and honor. Thanks for having me.